Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 14th, 2018. Brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to look at a number of developments that took place, including one where a taxpayer ended up having to include their son's savings accounts in a determination of whether they were solvent. The IRS announces the 2019 health retirement account amounts. The IRS makes some changes to a safe harbor computation when you buy a loss corporation to take into account changes made by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We have two revenue procedures dealing with changes in accounting methods, and a taxpayer had to deal with the fact that he couldn't get capital gain treatment because the court determined he had no asset to sell. Therefore, his income by default could not be capital gain income. It had to be ordinary. Well, we have a number of things to look at this week, and just one warning for you for next week. I will be traveling during the week, and I'm specifically going to have to come back on Saturday morning, or actually Saturday during the day. So we may be getting this out later next week. Just a fair warning for those of you that listen along or follow along. May not happen on Saturday morning. There's a possibility I could record from the hotel I'm going to be in early that morning. But I have a feeling more likely I will not be around and able to record this until sometime on Sunday next week. So hope to still get it out so it's available for those of you that listen in on Monday. But just fair warning, may not come out right on time this week, this coming week. Well, let's start with the first development. This is the case of Hamilton versus Commissioner. And this case deals with something that, you know, we had to deal with quite a bit a couple of years ago, and we're still dealing with pieces of because these things keep happening. That is the issue of taxation of cancellation of debt. In general, under Section 61A12, if a taxpayer has debts canceled, that's considered income. Now, it makes sense when you think about it. I go out and I borrow $100,000. I don't have income at that time because I'm going to pay this $100,000 back. But if it turns out that for whatever reason, I don't pay it back because, you know, things go bad. I put that $100,000. I thought that $100,000 was going to, you know, buy this wonderful property. It was going to make me a fortune. Turns out it was junk. Turns out actually, you know, I had to pay somebody to take it off my hands. And I don't have any other cash lying around. Well, at that point, when I don't pay the $100,000, then, you know, remember, the reason I didn't pick up his income at first was because I had to pay it back. I'm not going to. Well, that's income. That is an accession to wealth. But, of course, I've blown that wealth by now. Normally, that's the reason why I'm not repaying. So under Section 108 of the code, there are special rules that allow, if you meet certain criteria, where you don't have to pick those numbers up in income. Normally, you have to reduce tax attributes. And that means that you're going to have to do various issues there where the tax attributes are involved. You're going to have to reduce those attributes, pick them up as, you know, not take my NOLs in the future, maybe reduce the basis of assets. But I don't have to pay tax today because I don't have cash today. Well, that was the question coming here. The taxpayer was looking for an exclusion, cancellation of debt, under the insolvency provision found under Section 108A1B. Insolvency there generally looks at if a taxpayer liquidated all their assets, and we do not actually care if a creditor could not force you to sell the asset. So you have to count things like your 401k accounts, your IRAs, things that may be creditor protected, but you still count them. If I liquidated everything, would I have enough cash now to pay off all my creditors? If not, if I'm insolvent, liquidating everything would still leave me short of money to pay off the creditors, then at least to the extent of that insolvency, I don't recognize income. That was what was going on in this case. In this case, Mr. and Mrs. Hamilton had borrowed money and they'd used it for their son's education. So these are education loans. Now, following taking out the education loan, Mr. Hamilton injured his back. And that injury was diagnosed with degenerative disc disease, and he became permanently disabled, was unable to make the payments on the loan. Apparently, the son also did not make the payments on the loan. So they went to the bank and eventually negotiated a deal where Mr. Hamilton would not need to pay the debt. And the total debt that was discharged in this case was around $160,000 worth of debt that was discharged that Mr. Hamilton did not pay income tax on. Now, around the same time, Mr. Hamilton began engaging in what was described as erratic spending behavior. And he and his wife decided that they would transfer assets to their son's savings account. My guess is most likely to keep it from Mr. Hamilton's control. So they transferred it this time. They'd received $300,000+ for a 14.4% interest on the liability company they had. They'd received a distribution. It was non-taxable that came out to them from that LLC. And they took some other cash they had. They transferred that to a Chase savings account that was in their son's name. Now, their son gave his mother, not Mr. Hamilton, because, of course, that was our problem. Mr. Hamilton apparently would spend money erratically if we let him spend it. So Mrs. Hamilton had control. She was given the username and password for the account and had full authority to transfer money out of the account, use it to pay bills. And they did actually use it to pay various bills. So that's where expenses and things got paid out of. They had this account that was insulated from Mr. Hamilton. The question became, though, when time came to prepare the tax return for the year in question, the taxpayer's CPA did not include this bank account in the calculation of whether the taxpayers were solvent. Now the question becomes, should the CPA have included this account? What's important to note about this decision is we do not get the answer for this question from federal law. Rather, the courts turn to state law because the question here under the U.S. system of federalism, issues of property ownership generally are governed by state law, not federal law. That's why some states have community property rules for married couples. Most states don't. Okay, it's a difference in how these rules come down. In this case, the taxpayers who were living in Utah, we had to look at Utah's requirements for determining, even though something's titled in somebody's name, is that person really just holding it as a nominee for someone else? And do we treat the real owner of the account as that person it's being held for? The court decided under Utah law that you looked at six factors. And those factors were, did the taxpayer exercise dominion and control of the property while it was held in the son's name? Did the son pay little or nothing in consideration to get the property? Did the taxpayer place the property in their son's name in anticipation of a liability or lawsuit? Was there a close relationship between the taxpayer and the son? Did the taxpayer continue to enjoy the benefits of the property while it was in the son's name? And was the conveyance to the nominee, the son in this case, not recorded? Well, the court did agree in this case that they had not transferred it to avoid a liability, but the court felt that otherwise they basically met most of these requirements, that they effectively had control, continued to add access to the funds, that it really was being placed in the son's name, not because it was the son's asset. It really was their asset. So the court decided that under Utah state law, the son was merely a nominee. Because the son was merely holding it as a nominee, the court found you had to count this asset in computing whether the taxpayers were solvent or not. Now, what's our takeaway from this? Most of you listening to this probably are not licensed attorneys, right? You know, our website and the courses we offer are not really geared toward the legal profession, though some attorneys do come in and, you know, listen in and participate in courses, and I'm even going to be speaking at the Arizona State Bar Convention this year on the topic. So, you know, we got a couple of things, but I'm not an attorney, and most of you probably aren't either. One thing to be very careful here is to understand cases like this turn on issues outside of our area of expertise. The question of whether this asset was an asset of the parents is an issue of state law. Now, that said, we do know enough probably from these facts to suggest, you know, that might be a problem. But the question of whether there is a defensible position that this should not be included in the insolvency calculation is one that would have to go to a state law determination, meaning that assuming this is significant and $160,000 worth of income, probably significant, you probably need to ask for legal counsel who's skilled in the area of law that we need some information on to come to a conclusion about this under the state law and tell us, is there a position that we can take, you know, that is defensible, that you could defend as counsel, that would have this not be owned by the taxpayers, given the facts that we've got, given all the facts, assuming we know them all, can we do that? That's key, because one of the problems you run into here is, you know, clients, especially insolvent clients, are going to say, well, I don't want to go pay an attorney for this. But if you're going to defend this, you really do kind of need legal counsel to tell you whether or not the item is owned by the taxpayer. Next up, the IRS issued the limits for 2019, important to remember that year, for health savings accounts. Okay, so HSAs. The HSA limits for 2019 are now out. This was issued on May the 10th. Now, their 2019 limits, you may see, wow, that's awfully early, but HSA limits are always issued very early. The law requires health savings account limitations to be issued early in the prior year. Now, that got us into a little bit of trouble in for the 2018 numbers, because Congress came by in December, late December, and actually changed how we computed the inflation adjustment. The IRS initially did it the way Congress said to do it, you know, recomputed it, then discovered that would reduce it from what was originally announced. So eventually they had to back off. Hopefully this year we don't have that kind of confusion over what the numbers should be. Now, there are three different sets of numbers that apply: how much you can contribute to your HSA, what the maximum, what the minimum deductible has to be on the high deductible healthcare policy you have, and what the high deductible healthcare policy to be a high deductible healthcare policy has to set as your maximum out-of-pocket amounts. And this changes each year based on inflation adjustments. The annual contribution limits for 2019 will be $3,500 for somebody with self-only coverage. Under the HSA rules, self-only coverage is coverage that's just that. It covers only the taxpayer, not a dependent, not a spouse, just the taxpayer. If you have coverage for the taxpayer and a dependent, or and a spouse, or and a dependent and a spouse, or three dependents and a spouse, then that's called family coverage. And if you have family coverage, the maximum contribution for next year is going to be $7,000. When you go to get a health care policy, to be a high deductible health policy in 2019 for self-only coverage, it's going to have a minimum deductible of $1,350. For that family plan, it's going to have a minimum deductible of $2,700. And please remember that minimum deductible is not a, is a total family deductible. We don't get $1,350 for each person, you know, but rather $2,700 for the whole. So that family coverage, $2,700. That's the max, that's the minimum deductible. And then the maximum out of pocket. And by the way, they are allowed in issuing the policy to limit this to in-network coverage, will be for self-only coverage, $6,750, and for family coverage, $13,500. Now, again, remember, these are the 2019 numbers. They're issued, but they've had been issued every year early in the year. So don't go run with these for 2018 tax returns. Don't go out there and, you know, start throwing this much money in, although the numbers don't go up dramatically, to go up some. Rather, understand that these numbers are going to be what are in effect for 2019. So make sure when you set up your HSA, when you start setting up your health plans for 19, and you consider how much you're putting into the plans, into your health savings account, these are the numbers you'll be using. Next up, Notice 2018-30, issued on May the 8th. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act changed a lot of things. One thing it changed that had an impact elsewhere was the change under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to take bonus depreciation and no longer limit it to new assets, assets first use being by the taxpayer. This had a backdoor impact on the rules under Section 382 that limit your ability to buy loss corporations. 382 serves to limit the ability of a taxpayer to go out and buy a corporation that, let's say, has a $10 million loss, and you're going to start a business, you know it's going to be profitable. So you buy this $10 million loss corporation. And what you're doing is, so I might pay somebody, let's say $500,000 for it, because it's a disaster. The business has never worked right. You know, it has all these losses. He's paid off all the liabilities, but I'm just going to buy this $10 million loss now, this NOL. The only thing left is the NOL. So I buy this corporation with a $10 million NOL. I then start my brand new business inside the corporation. And under, if we didn't have 382, I'd be able to have my first $10 million tax-free. And under current law, again, as a C corp, that'd give me $2.1 million. So, you know, I saved $2.1 million in taxes. I paid $500,000 to the guy to buy this thing. I'm still way ahead, except 382 blocks you from doing that. Now, 382 is not concerned just with loss corporations that have big NOLs. It's also concerned that maybe you bought this corporation and it has all this equipment in it and it's on the books at $20 million, but you know it's really only worth 10. And so when you buy it, you know that if I just dispose of that equipment, I'm going to generate this $10 million loss. So I don't buy the NOL. I buy this built-in loss. Well, similar rules apply to built-in losses. Now, the safe harbor calculations allow you to still claim some of those deductions and excess losses if it represents, you know, what's called recognized built-in gain. That if, you know, for some reason, because let's say there was this piece of equipment that was fully depreciated, but it was really worth $2 million. Well, the court's going to allow you to the safe harbor allows you to treat, let's say, the depreciation on that asset that you would have gotten the first year had you not, you know, had you bought the assets. They'll treat that as a recognized built-in gain, and you'll be able to effectively consider losses up to that. There are similar rules, though, that look at the recognized built-in losses and deal with that depreciation you're claiming that you really shouldn't be able to. So same issue, we have those rules. Those calculations under 382 for recognized built-in gain and recognized built-in loss, well, they were looking at what depreciation you would have got. Now, under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, though, virtually every asset inside that, all that equipment's going to qualify for bonus depreciation that I bought the assets. So I've taken 100% depreciation on both the first year. That obviously is going to foul up the calculation we were using previously to allow us how much of a built-in gain recognition we have, or, you know, what sort of built-in loss adjustment goes in there. Well, the IRS decided, hey, realistically, this was meant to provide us with a way to spread this out. The intent of Congress at the time was not to have this now craziness happen, where suddenly the first year would have everything come through, all the basis differences would drop in this calculation in year one, and then there'd be different issues going forward. So what the IRS has said, for these built-in loss calculations under 382, you're not to use bonus depreciation. Okay, so we don't use bonus depreciation in using these recognized built-in loss, recognized built-in gain, safe harbors, using either the 338 or the 1374 methods. And you can take a look in more detail in the guidance. We just roughly explained how this works. If you have that problem, you should always consult this guidance. But this modifies notice 2003-65. It modifies it now to make this change. You still do it the way 2003-65 says, except we now have clarified, don't use bonus depreciation in doing it. Next up, change of accounting methods. And we're going to talk about two revenue procedures here, Revenue Procedure 2018-29, which was issued on May the 10th. And then the next thing we'll talk about will be a revenue procedure that was actually issued the day before, but it has a later number, 2018-31. These both deal with accounting methods and automatic changes of accounting methods. So let's quickly review how accounting methods work. First question is, what's an accounting method? For tax purposes, an accounting method is anything that does not affect the amount of income or deduction that will eventually be running through the tax return, but does affect the tax year in which that will happen. So for instance, you know, If I'm on the cash basis of accounting, CPA firm, I bill a client for work. Again, I'm calendar year, let's assume. I bill a client for work on December 31st. I bill them for $1,000 worth of work. If I'm on the cash basis, I don't recognize that $1,000 yet. I recognize it the following year when the client pays me. But if I'm on the accrual basis of accounting, I recognize that $1,000 in the year in which it's billed. I'm not changing how much I recognize. I'm going to recognize $1,000. But I'm changing when it's recognized. If you do that, you are required to have IRS permission to make a change in the method being used. That's what an accounting method is. It can be an overall method, or it can be a method for a specific type of transaction. As long as it meets the requirement that it doesn't change the amount, but it does change when things are recognized, it's an accounting method change. Now, those of you who dabble in A&A along with your tax work may recall we have this thing coming up called ASC 606, Revenues from Contracts with Customers. And that is a new way of looking at recording revenue that was put into place by FASB in Accounting Standards Update 2014-09. The same standard was adopted by IFRS as IFRS number 15. Public companies are beginning to recognize it this year and having to use it this year. Non-public companies who are doing GAAP financials are going to recognize it next year. Now, the catch is, this deals with revenue recognition, and what it does, the same thing as tax. We're now going to take all these various industry methods that have been used for recognizing revenue under U.S. GAAP, and we're going to instead go to a centralized way of calculating, of determining when we should recognize revenue. So this centralized way of recognizing when we have to pick up revenue is going to, you know, start taking effect this year. And it's going to change when things appear on the financial statements for taxpayers who have these contracts. Now, the IRS asked for some guidance here, and you know, we do kind of expect it's going to have some impact on a number of taxpayers. ASC 606 will have impacts on construction contractors because it's going to make some changes there. It's going to have impact on software companies. It's going to have impact on any companies that sell service contracts and those sorts of things. Again, all of this deals with the timing issues. Now, those of you on the GAAP side, remember all the criteria we use for when we recognize income and all the issues that'll change this. And probably if you're in a public company, you've already been in the middle of making this transition. If you're a private company, it's going to be issuing GAAP financial statements. Hopefully you started working on how this is going to impact you. The question becomes, you know, previously I've been reporting for tax purposes the same way I did on my GAAP financials. I want to now keep doing it, but this is changing. Can I do this and how do I do this? Well, this particular procedure, 2018-29, provides an automatic change method. That's the good news, because otherwise you have to ask for permission up front on 3115, which means you would have to be filing for a non-public company those 3115s right now and hope you'll get permission by the time you have to file your 18 return. Public companies should essentially have already been well in the process, have already gotten those filed, if it was going to be a non-automatic method. Well, the IRS told us, you know, that we're going to give some automatic methods. So just, hold your horses. They told us that last year. Now we've got this issued. One big thing to notice, though, it does not give carte blanche to use GAAP methods. Couple of limits here. First thing is, it's not going to, allow you to change calculation of the transaction price, because that wouldn't be a method. That'd be an amount issue. That's a difference. This does not yet deal with the one we're going to have to deal with under 451. We'll talk about, that particular change. That's the revenue conformity rule. That one's going to be dealt with later, so be rid of it. It doesn't qualify if there's already an automatic change to get to where you want to go. You're supposed to use that change. It doesn't also qualify for changes to long-term contracts. So construction contractors know you can't use this to get onto GAAP methods. The other thing that has, gotten a few people in an article in Tax Analysts this week mentioned, is a lot of companies in reviewing this discovered they had other issues with GAAP. They weren't doing the GAAP reporting right, and so they're making those changes at the same time. This won't cover those. If you want to get your tax line in, you want to get your tax reporting in line with what's now proper GAAP reporting, but you hadn't been doing it properly, doesn't cover that either. The guidance on the 451 conformity will come later. Now, the good news is this ruling provides a simplified method for getting your benefit. It also allows us to do it on a cutoff basis rather than using a 481 four-year spread. That may make it much simpler to implement because you won't have to calculate that 41 four-year spread. The catch being, and you will just be able to do it, but you can still use the four-year spread. Consolidated groups will be allowed, you know, are going to be basically required to group things together. But they do tell you that if you have multiple, and if you have multiple changes because you have different types of revenue, you can ask for multiple changes on the same 3115, but you have to separately compute and disclose any 41A adjustments, and you cannot net 41A adjustments. So you won't just get a total 41A adjustments for, you know, the 32 different types of revenue you've got. You're going to have to basically separately compute your 41A adjustments and disclose them on the 3115. Now, the timing of this was kind of interesting. It came out the day after the IRS issued another revenue procedure, one that we see every year, Revenue Procedure 2018-31, this time issued on the 9th of May. And this is just an update to the standard list of automatic changes, the comprehensive list. For reasons that I'm sure the IRS has their reasons, but they did not include the 606 changes on the big automatic list change. So I suspect, so they don't have to take it back off in a couple of years and explain they're taking it off. By the way, I should say that 606 change only applies for one of the first 3 years that you've adopted the new FASB requirements. If you're in year four of using the new 606, then we're back to the old ways of having to get permission to change. This particular comprehensive list, it takes effect immediately. There are some transition rules if you have a request in process right now. And let's say that that request is one that now is an automatic method. You can ask the IRS to stop processing. They'll send back your user fee and then use the automatic method. Conversely, if you have a method that was automatic, and there are a couple of those that was allowed as automatic under last year's list, but now is no longer on the list, as long as you had filed the request, the automatic request, prior to the date this took effect, you're fine. But if you hadn't filed it yet, like you haven't filed the return, sorry, guys, you don't get the automatic change. Again, so you may want to review that. If you have any 3115s you're going to be doing for returns that are on extension, you know, or any return, any ones you plan to do for this year, you want to review this list again. It has some subtle changes in many places, not anything huge, but there are changes throughout the document. Now, it does not cover a few things. First, as mentioned earlier, the 606 numbers we just talked about, those changes. Doesn't qualify the small business accounting method relief. That's also one we expect to have that we don't have yet. Remember, if you're under $25 million, you're going to be able to get out of 263 Cap A. You're going to be able to go cash basis. We have lots of things going to happen there. We don't have guidance on whether any relief is going to be granted there or what type. And we don't have the 451 changes. And again, the last two, we have nothing on either one of those as of yet. Keep your eyes open. Those are both to come. Finally, we're going to kind of review an issue that was actually decided many years ago. This taxpayer, unfortunately, didn't know it. Apparently, PEXA versus United States, or more importantly, the taxpayer's advisor didn't know it. This was case number 2:16CV00994 from the U.S. District Court of the Eastern District of California. The opinion was issued on May the 7th. This was a taxpayer. The taxpayer had been a district manager, right, in this case, for Farmers Insurance. And what he had done, he had been an agent for a number of years, then got promoted to district manager. As a district manager, he could no longer sell the insurance. So he transferred his old insurance agency to his sister. She paid him over a term of years. He treated the proceeds from that sale, obviously the interest, he treated as interest income, but the other proceeds from the sale, he treated as long-term capital gain for selling goodwill to his sister. He had been examined a couple of times. The IRS had never raised any question about that sale. And that sale is not what's going to be a question here. But as part of his agreement for leaving Farmers, Farmers agreed to pay him certain termination payments. So basically, he got paid money from Farmers Insurance, right? Those payments were issued to him on a 1099 miscellaneous. Now, the taxpayer said, well, I think this is a payment for sale of goodwill. And as it was goodwill, I was paid for my contract value, is what Farmers called it. This is considered to be a long-term capital gain, and I should get long-term capital gain treatment. You know, so it was reported there as capital gain. He argued it was capital gain effectively on the sale of goodwill. But here's the problem. Some of you may remember this. This bigger issue had been before the courts before. In fact, the Seventh Circuit in the Baker case had in 2003 decided that these termination payments for insurance agents and district directors and the like, these are really ordinary income. Because according to the agreements they have with the insurance companies, and he had the same type with Farmers, they didn't own any assets. There were no rights. Farmers controlled everything. And so, as I said, you had no goodwill to sell. You couldn't sell it to Farmers because you didn't have it. His agreement, and by the way, the Ninth Circuit, which is where the appeal of this would go, in the Trantina case, had held the same thing. Now, interesting little personal aside, the Charlie Trantina of the Trantina case back in the 90s when he retired, that agent was actually the agent when I first got my first insurance coverage out of high school. He was the agent my father used. So obviously, you know, your parents use something, you're 16-year-old, they put you on the policy. So I actually was for many years a customer of Mr. Trantina, never met Mr. Trantina. He had a really, really large, brokerage business in the West Valley of Phoenix, actually in Sun City area. So interesting enough was there, but Trantina, they said, Mr. Trantina, bad news for my former agent. That's also ordinary income. The court found that there was no difference in Mr. Baker, of Mr. Pexa here, then there had been, he was in the same position as Mr. Baker and Mr. Trantina. This, he didn't own anything. And one of the key issues is you can't have a gain on the sale of a capital asset unless you own the asset. So the question where there was a capital asset in play doesn't matter if you don't own it. They said since he owned no assets, under his agreement, all assets were owned by Farmers Insurance. Because of that, all the gain was capital gain. Now, he also held, which was interesting, he said, wait a minute. I relied on my tax professional to deal with this. And his tax professional had made the decision it was capital gain. But he never provided to the tax professional a copy of his agreement with Farmers. And as the court said, that was the key issue. And, you know, this guy could not have given advice because you never gave him the key things. You always just gave him summaries. You told him Farmers was paying you. And based on what you told him, he decided, well, that must be capital gain. But he never got a look at a document to determine if you owned an asset. Okay, he said, well, even that, look, they still allowed me on my sister to treat that as capital gain. And obviously, according to my agreement, you just told me to own anything there either. But the IRS never objected to that. Doesn't that insulate me from penalties? The answer of the court was no. They said, the fact the IRS allowed things for prior years is not a defense against penalties in the current year. They're saying first thing is that's a separate transaction. We're not looking at that. So we don't, you know, we're not going to say that that transaction has been reported wrong. But they said, but even if it was, it doesn't matter. There's no protection. You know, you can't rely on the IRS position on a different transaction in prior years to claim to insulate you from penalties on your reporting on a brand new transaction in a later year. So again, now, as I said, this with insurance agents, well-known, part of the reason why I'm bringing it up this week is because it has been a while probably since most of us remember that issue. In fact, you may have been in practice back, you know, about not quite, you know, let's say, so it was 15 years ago. We got the cases that dealt with this, but it was a really big deal at the time. Just remember, those things are generally, especially to agencies like Farmers, State Farm, you know, where basically you only sell that one company's policy. That's going to be ordinary income when those people leave and get their retirement payments from the insurance company, you know, their contract value payments. As always, we want to remind you this session and this whole broadcast wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the courses being offered by your State Society of CPAs that we offer them through them. So that's how we pay the bills. So I want to remind you to go ahead and take a look at your State Society's catalog and do it not necessarily because you just want to pay the bills for us, although that's nice if you want to, and we certainly would like that, but also consider it because it's a good place to get live interactive sessions. And given the changes we've had in the tax law this year, being able to talk not just with the instructor, which is always useful in the course, but being able to actually interact with the people in the room, you get a lot of ideas in a live course you simply cannot get when you're taking a course that is being taken as a self-study program and where you're answering a bunch of check-the-box questions or you're listening to a taped webinar. So considering signing up for your State Society's courses, either, you know, preferably live, because I think you get the most being there and having the interaction with people. But even if not, take some of the broadcast courses they're going to be working on where we broadcast the live sessions. Those are also useful. You get here at least some of the in-room interaction. And, you know, you do get the chance to do in real time possess questions. So take a look. Your State Society catalogs are out right now. Take a look. I've got a number of courses offered in a number of states this year. We've got them from other Kaplan instructors, both in ANA and tax, and the State Societies have other courses from other very qualified vendors. So go ahead and take a look there. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments again for the week of May the 14th, 2018. Be sure to catch our updates during the week at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me. My address is edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I post at Ed Zollers is the address I post at. Most of my posts, the vast majority of them, relate to tax developments, so you can follow me there. I will post a couple of other things from time to time, but mainly tax developments. And if you want to as well, I participate in discussions on the subreddit at reddit.com/r/taxpros. So you can follow me there. If you're a CPA or attorney, you also can join in the private discussion group, the Tax Pros Discussion Group, which is run by the California Society of CPAs. I usually jump into a couple of conversations there too. They're useful places to bounce off people and, you know, get some ideas going. Otherwise, hopefully you're having a good week. Hopefully you're getting through all of those extension returns. And we look forward to seeing you again next week here on Current Federal Tax Developments.